Welcome, patrons. Left Reckoning, this is not a think tank. I'm Matt Leck, with me, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, man, how's it going? Enjoying the weekend so far?
It is. I got to see my cousin pitch at Citi Field last night. It was cold as hell, but it was very enjoyable, despite it being a difficult game. The Mets were hitting very well. But besides that, you're going to a movie. Is that right?
I am going to a movie later. I'm seeing Minari.
Interesting.
I'm a little excited for that.
I thought about it last night when I saw The Quiet Place 2. Because I enjoyed The Quiet Place, the original Quiet Place.
Oh, yeah?
Wasn't
because you're a big horror guy.
I am. I like a well-crafted, suspenseful horror movie, and that one was pretty good. And I'm not even a fan of, you know, CIA John Krasinski, but Quiet Place was good. So I'm anxious to see the second one, but I don't know. Movie theater. Yeah, I'm gonna do it probably in the next couple of weeks. I'm ready.
Why not, man? It's like I'm excited. Been a long time. That, and it's been really, man, it's like insanely beautiful here. It was supposed to be a rainy, like thunderstorm weekend. There's the big march, you know, protesting the horrible abortion ban here yesterday. That was huge turnout. And it was one of those things where you felt really lucky that it wasn't just a big downpour. It's like beautiful sunny skies. And
oh yeah,
I don't know, man. I'm in a very positive mood these days. Just because of having a little sunshine, got some barbecue meats coming up tomorrow, making some nice ribs and stuff.
Do you go to a butcher?
So there are a couple of really good butchers here, but man, I got to tell you, HEB, the Texas grocery store, is one of the most amazing places. I honestly, I'm such an idiot every time I go there, or I just must look like a moron to my girlfriend, because they have the meat section, you know, where you get your steaks and hamburgers. And then my local one, they have this huge, you know, like on the ground refrigerator that's just filled with ribs, brisket, and all this stuff. And even if I'm not even remotely considering barbecuing, I always just sort of look, you know, just like longingly and everything, because it really is such a treat after being deprived so long of like good quality, you know, barbecue smoke and stuff.
Yeah, getting used to the small grocery stores, even the good ones here. Like I'm used to in Fargo going to the massive like chain grocery stores, Hornbacher's or whatever, and they're just huge and have so much space, so many aisles.
Yeah, I know. It's like HEB, like, you know, we don't really stand corporations on here. And I know HEB is not a perfect corporation when it comes to their labor practices and things like that. But man, it really is a special place. And I live right by the one I used to go to as a kid too. I don't know. It's sort of fun though. Very different. I mean, the clientele has definitely changed a little bit.
Interesting. I'm just thinking of the Hank Hill when he goes, what's the big mart?
What, Megalomart?
Megalomart. all right, well let's start with another Megalomart. We have this video here from Uber, and it's called, this is an unlisted video from December 7th 2016 called Navigating Government Relations and Conflicts of Interest, and we're only the 2955th person to watch this video, but it's pretty interesting. The comment made by Avina Duval, who's a professor at the University of California, Hastings of Law, says, this is a hilarious video directed at Uber lobbyists and employees, warning them to avoid bribing government officials to maintain the company's integrity. Meanwhile, the whole business is based on breaking laws. Obviously, we could talk about more about that after this. Here's this video.
Uber is growing fast. As we enter new markets and expand in existing ones, our success depends in large part on building great relationships with government officials, lobbyists, and other companies. As you build those relationships, here are a few things to keep in mind. Be loyal to Uber. You obviously want to avoid any conflict of interest that might prevent you from making decisions in the best interest of the company. Even the appearance of a conflict of interest can be damaging. So be mindful of our policies when accepting any gifts or favors from third parties. Uber faces fierce competition in some of the places where we operate, but we never buy market access, business, or policy outcomes. Instead, we grow our business by offering the very best product and fighting for the right legislation.
Not true.
We all need to be especially vigilant when we work with...
What does fighting for the right legislation mean?
That's definitely not buying market share, Matt.
with government officials at every level. We can cover reasonable travel expenses or meals to explain how our service works.
Looks nice.
Or give people a taste of Uber's culture with some branded swag. But laws around the world prohibit us from offering anything of value to a government employee in exchange for legislative or regulatory outcomes. Please review our global anti-corruption policy if you're considering giving anything to a government official. Remember that these ground rules also apply to the consultants, lobbyists, and lawyers who interact with governments on our behalf. According to global anti-corruption laws, Uber can be held responsible for the actions of these third parties. So be careful about the company you keep. In the end, we all want to work for a company we respect. So be mindful and act with integrity.
Wow.
The loyalty to Uber thing is very interesting to me. Like, don't embarrass us, basically.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so funny to present your you know activities in that way, when like two of the biggest stories of last year were about Uber very much trying to put their thumb on the scale when it came to the initiatives in California. Now they're trying to do the same thing up north too in New York. It's I don't know. It's exceptional.
It's, you know, this is a focus on
why the hell they're talking about how they don't buy marketplace access when like the other half of the video is all talking about their policy regarding their lobbyists.
It's really like, don't get busted doing petty shit. Like, we got this. Like, you don't need to like this isn't the share Rolex with a guy. Like, we'll bankroll him and the rest of the candidates they need, right? Like,
yeah,
like
exactly.
this is like, let's be smart, folks, and not get greedy, because we don't worry. Uber, Travis Kalanick, I think he's out now, but like the guy that was paying private eyes to follow reporters, it's that loyalty to Uber thing. I didn't register that the first time I watched this, but that is like, it really says it all there. But like, this isn't we're an ethically sound company. It's don't fuck this up for us by making a news story because you gave some city councilor free rides for a year or some shit like that.
I mean, no, exactly. And also don't fuck this up because we have a huge cannon of money that we're already willing to spend in the most blatant and registered way possible.
Yeah,
so no reason to go. I think like the biggest thing that the reason that this is interesting is because for Uber, though, their entire future and livelihood does depend on doing the complete opposite of what they're trying to present in that video, which is they need governments to support their business model, especially now that they've basically come all out and admitted that there is not going to be a self-driving car future for them. They need to make sure that they can skirt any kind of labor law, any kind of protections, any kind of common sense regulations that go through taxi hail, companies in the rest of the world. So they actually do need to be thrown a lot of money to be able to buy as much marketplace as possible.
Yeah. And we'll probably cover this maybe on the next issue, but New York State is toying with the same kind of Prop 22 sellout. And I need to look at more details on that, but it's amazing how much these contours, it's from the same, what I keep forgetting, what the clean slate or whatever, the Harvard clean slate.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Clean slate.
It's the same thing in Prop 22. It's this fancy way of not giving you full benefits.
Yep.
In the interest of flexibility and whatever the fuck, right? Like the modern workforce needs flexibility, by which you mean, what do they call it? The scheduling where it's like, I remember the scheduling based on like fucking either McDonald's or Caribou Coffee, or where it's like, absolutely zero like until you see the schedule posted on the wall, zero idea of what your hours are going to be.
But that's the thing. I mean, honestly, like that's the thing that's so cynical about like Uber and Lyft's business model is like, so now you're starting to see in California a lot of drivers are raising the alarm that their profits are down big time,
right?
And that's not accidental. Uber and Lyft knew exactly what was going to happen. But that's how they operate in like the grand you know, the grand scale too. So they typically, they come into a new city, right? They offer extremely generous, or, you know, relatively so, like signing bonuses and things like that. They pay,
subsidized by investor cash,
subsidized so that they can pay drivers a lot of money. So people, the consumer stops, you know, using taxis because it's cheaper to use Uber. Mm-hmm. And then drivers stop wanting to drive for taxis or other services because, you know, you can make a nice little bit of money. But as soon as that competition starts to dry up, Uber then starts reducing the amount of money that drivers make. So much so that, you know, people who were coming in and were making $4,000 or $5,000 a month are now barely skating by, making $2,000 and driving almost double the amount of time that they were initially, right? And like, that's how they really sneak in. So they come into a town and people are like, oh, well, this is great. This is a new kind of futuristic, you know, business model. It's beneficial for me. I'm going to commit myself full time to this company. I'm going to, you know, sink a lot of money invested into my own private vehicle, which again, that's another great way that right. these companies operate, is by putting all of the investment on the actual machines that are needed to operate their company on the worker. And then once they basically have a dominant share of the market, they can start dictating you know, policies to people, and they have the ability then to pay people extremely low wages because there aren't as many other options and all of the other services have almost completely dried up, right? Mm-hmm. And you're invested at that point. You've quit your other job. You've sunk $20,000 into your, you know, Hyundai, and you know, you're just trying to get by. It's a really, really cynical way that they operate, and the way that they're now doing that in politics is even more despicable, where they're, you know, they're basically going into these things are making it seem, you know, like things are going to turn out very differently on the other side until they get their way. And then boom, you know, oh, we're a big company. We can't really, you know, guarantee this kind of, you know, basic income to all of our employees.
Yeah. I mean, just like the notifications that both drivers and riders got about, hey, this is seriously going to affect your material life. And then all those promises they made about, like, this is what we're going to do instead. This is what we'll do instead of Prop 22. Of course, it's like a bad boyfriend. Like, those promises were purely for the moment to get you through a tough spot. And they got them through it. And now fuck it. Like, we're going to do what we do, which is squeeze labor for profit.
You know, I got to find it. And maybe we can put in the show notes or something. It's a very funny, like, thing. I think Tim Fowles was tweeting about it a couple weeks ago and I got really engrossed in it. There's this woman here in the Austin area who writes these like really long reviews on Yelp of like places like Olive Garden and you know just kind of like random kind of typical American places like that. But throughout all of these reviews, like, you're getting her like life story. Like, she like converts to Buddhism, gets sober, you know, gets a job, you know, and like all these things. And they're really funny and sweet. And she's like really upbeat and like seems like a genuinely, you know, lovely person. But, you know, she's doing these like, you know, 5-star Yelp reviews of like, you know, Red Lobster and stuff. So it's very funny to read like about like your life going into it. But there's a really tragic subtext to it as I was reading through them. It's having a little bit too much time on my hands a couple weeks ago. You know, over these like 7-year period, because she starts driving for Uber and Lyft, and it's really, really good for her up front. She's so happy. She's able to afford all these different things. You know, it's the sketch, like all the things, like almost like Uber propaganda. It's like, I have the freedom to like select my own hours, things like that. But as time goes on, things start to get more and more difficult for her financially, and she's not making as much money on Uber and Lyft as she was when she first started. And, you know, she's getting worried because she's sunk all this money in the car. And I don't know. It's like a really a tragic story, but it's not an individual one. It's like, it's something that's just showing up in a kind of random kind of like, you know, a chance example, right? That there's somebody who's chronicling their life through these like Yelp reviews, but it's something that is very much like shared by a lot of people. And it's, and reading in that context and sort of knowing, you know, what's going on behind the scenes is really tragic.
Damn, that's, I mean, yeah, like, have you ever heard an Uber driver say, yeah, I'm, yeah, actually things are getting better and better? Like, never.
That's never. True, yeah. I don't know, man. It's and the gig work is coming everywhere.
Yeah.
Which is the really tragic reality, because they're understanding that, as we were talking about with Jathan, it's like, you know, technology can do one thing, but what's much more effective is finding, you know, clever ways to skirt basic labor laws and protections, and obscuring the cost of doing business for the consumer and for, like, the, you know, the independent contractor, the employee as well.
Yeah. It's a shame. I thought all these tech guys just wanted to give us all better lives, but
well, we should talk about another tech guy who found a way to really miserate lots and lots of people, Jeff Bezos. Because this story here is, I don't know, it's this is in Jackman, or also in the Daily Poster, which y'all should definitely subscribe to and check out if you haven't already.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't notice they were doing sort of
cross. Oh yeah, they were doing these cross posts.
That's cool.
For a little while now. But yeah, so this story is just, it's one of those things that's like, none of this is surprising, but you just got kind of keep pointing it out, because it is extremely worrying to see how prevalent, like, native advertising is becoming in media. So for people who aren't familiar, Jeff Bezos, the owner of the world's largest sweatshop, is now the, you know, is the owner of the Washington Post. And despite all of the rhetoric that he put forward about how he's doing it because he wants to, you know, defend democracy and, you know, yeah, support journalism.
When guys like Jeff Bezos talk about democracy, what they mean is, like, people's willingness to keep indulging capitalism.
Yes.
Like, basically.
You know, so he buys the Washington Post, which, I'm sorry, like, I'm not even talking about as a socialist at this point, like, just like a common sense, like, liberal should, yep, say that billionaires should not be able to own news media. Yeah. It really is such a throwback to the Gilded Age.
Well, I forget when exactly did he, it was during Obama, right?
Yeah, it was later in Obama, because it was an interesting, because I was still living in D.C. when he bought it. And it was an interesting thing, because D.C., is culturally is an interesting town, and people who aren't from there or haven't lived there, it's a little difficult to explain, because there is the world that you think of, right, which is like the super political world, but there also is, like, a really lovely city and community that is just completely stomped on by, you know, just armies of congressional staffers and think tank employees and, you know, the American state, like, bureaucracy, right, just get completely thrown into the wolves. So I always feel bad when people, like, talk about DC, like, you know, in an abstract sense, because there are all these people who really do live there and are lovely, aren't these, you know, just drones. But I do remember when Jeff Bezos started to really start paying attention to Washington, D.C., and everyone was all excited. He bought a big ass house downtown. He was investing in, like, Alexandria and, like, you know, in Northern.
Honestly, Virginia. Like, this shit is like the DuPonts in the 1860s. Like, oh, they're in town. They like I'm reading, like, the Bismarck Tribune in 1873. And there's a section in each paper that just announces, like, powerful people are in town and what hotels they're staying at. And it's like, yeah, this, it's the same fucking shit. The small ass, like, the oligarchy pattern that's been going on for, like, hundreds of years in this country.
Well, it's for sure. But it was also very funny when you're reading all these, like, think pieces or, like, celebrations, like, oh, wow, people are finally, because there's DC, people who live in DC, like the upper class people in DC have this real inferiority complex with, like, New York and, like, the absolutely other, like, big cities, right? It's like, oh, they don't respect that we have fancy restaurants and stuff like that. So Jeff Bezos, like, you know, residing there, buying a house there and spending a lot of time there, people are like, wow, this just proves that, like, DC is, like, now this, like, cultural capital, and it's a city for not just for politics but for business too. It's like, no, the richest man in the country is trying to put his footprint in the part of the country where all the decisions are made, and trying to make it very easy for him to influence folks. And there was no better example of that when he bought the Washington Post, which, again, people are trying to act like, oh, he just bought the hometown paper of Washington, D.C., right? It's like, no, he's buying one of the most influential newspapers that covers politics in the country.
Yeah, as if, like, why is he doing this? It must be maybe his interests in democracy. Are you fucking kidding me?
And obviously, you know, despite all of the, you know, the hand wringing that we get from defenders of this system, that there is like a pretty strict firewall between Bezos and the editorial stuff. And look, there are a lot of great reporters at the Washington Post. I'm not going to sit here and say don't read the paper or engage with people's work there. There are a lot of people who have very serious criticisms of people like Jeff Bezos who are employed there. But when we're talking about, you know, the system or the paper, like, you know, as an institution that does a lot of different things, you have to recognize that there is, even if it's not overt, a decision not to focus on certain things regarding Jeff Bezos and his empire, right? Like, look, they put out critical stories from time to time, you know, about Bezos and Amazon. But there is certainly a decision, one, to give heads up. That also some things are off limits, you know, things like that. Anyway, this example here about the native advertising that David Sirota and Andrew Perez brought up in the Daily Poster is exceptionally egregious, where he, you know, who's now facing a lot of, pushback against the horrible working conditions at Amazon. He is now using the front page of the Washington Post as a way to push his message. So the front page of the Washington Post has this big banner ad, and it has two women holding a dog in a fairly nice kitchen saying, "Since we're both making more than $15 an hour, Mom and I could get a bigger place." I will say, I can't imagine anybody. This is not a house of a wage worker for people who are listening to this. This is actually a very, very nice kitchen.
Yeah.
But that's not the most, that's not the most egregious part about this ad. It's right where the banner head typically is, where they would write, where they would put statements of the paper.
The New York Times always puts all the news that's fit to print in its corner, for instance.
So they make it seem like this isn't a part of the ad, basically, which is why it's egregious. And they put in one text box, since 2018, Amazon has paid at least $15 an hour. And the second text box, which again makes it seem like it's coming from the paper, not from the ad, it's time to raise the $7.25 a federal minimum wage. And it's the nastiest example of how native advertising really is able to bleed into, a paper like that and make it seem like these are things that are coming from the editorial board and not something that the paper is getting paid to print.
Yeah. Well, also remember the lesson from Bessemer about Amazon's repeated emphasis of the $15 minimum wage, which is that a lot of the jobs that they are squeezing are paid more than $15 anyway, historically. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's a very, very clever way of exploiting how horrible labor is treated in this country generally, pointing the fingers away from themselves when actually they're the exact same part of the process. They're just going after slightly higher paying jobs to try to get those wages down.
I think that's a good point. And also remember that in a lot of communities now, you know, Amazon is becoming an extremely, like a very large employer. And because they are like essentially the people who are buying up the majority of the labor in a community, they have immense power to hold wages down, right? Because the amount of value that Amazon worker provides to the company each hour far exceeds $15 an hour, like by far. Right, they wouldn't be paying them $15 an hour if that wasn't the case. So what Amazon is doing with this kind of fixation about the, oh, we're so progressive, we're paying this high wage. One, $15 an hour minimum wage is not an impressive wage or a very progressive way to pay people. We're saying that this is the bare minimum, and anything else should be illegal. Right. When we're talking about a minimum wage. And oftentimes people forget that because we have such a horrible and bizarre and anti-worker wage system in this country. And two, Amazon acts as if like one day Jeff Bezos woke up and he, you know, started thinking about the men and women who made him into, you know, one of the wealthiest people in human history. And then he said, you know what? I think it's time for them to get a bigger cut of the pie. That wasn't the case at all. Like, this happened because they were being exposed for their horrible working conditions by activists, by politicians, and by labor. And there was a huge pressure campaign to make them increase the wages and benefits that they were paying employees, right?
Right.
So to sit here and try to put a progressive face on it is despicable too.
Yeah. I mean, that is, it is, for all the clumsiness of the Amazon PR response, that line is ultimately very clever. Mm-hmm. And I imagine we'll see stuff like that happen before. Like, you get dragged kicking and screaming, and then you, yeah, portray yourself as some sort of industry leader.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and it's even worse when you read some of the other stuff in the Washington Post regarding the minimum wage later. But that might be a conversation for another time. But I think it's important to remember what Jason was pointing out to us on Thursday's show too, that, you know, technology and kind of like novelties, feeling like things are new and different, oftentimes obscures the fact that the wage question and the labor question really hasn't moved much in the past century. If you look at the kind of surveillance that the Amazon workers are faced with on the job, it's very similar to having an overseer over your shoulder, right? We just have created better ways to do it. But this kind of idea that, like, oh, well, we don't have, like, you know, the kind of the classic image of like industrial capitalism, like the cruel and depressing factory, right? Now it's like we have team members and things like that. It's like these function almost exactly in the same way. Any kind of criticism that you have of like industrial capitalism, that kind of like the factory setting, it's very similar to what's going on the shop floor in most of these Amazon warehouses. And in a lot of ways, is worse today than it was then.
It didn't come up, I don't think, in our talk with Jathan, but in the book, he talks about Amazon patenting bracelets that make sure your hands are doing the right actions in a fast enough time frame, which is, think about that, able to, yeah. And you could get like a buzzer if you're not like moving your hands fast enough, right? Which is just, that is straight out of like the sort of worst Taylorism nightmares of 100+ years ago.
I mean, I think so. And as a bow on that, like Jathan in a talk also made a really great point that the movie, the Charlie Chaplin movie, yeah, Modern Times, is very similar to an Amazon workplace, which was both a great reference. And people who haven't seen that movie, it really is phenomenal. And it's frightening just how like accurate it is today.
Well, yeah, it's like, the examples we're all sort of familiar with from even like socialist realism, where like people getting like pulled into gears and stuff like that and ripped apart into shreds. But like these human, like these warehouses, right? And then they have these human free zones, human exclusion zones, where they have like,
God, what a term.
You cannot go there or you will get murdered by robots because they're just whipping around. It really is amazing. And we will see, like, for what they say about like a human exclusion zone, I guarantee a human is going to die in there because of some sort of like, they have to do some sort of maintenance in a timely fashion. Like, right. Like,
I don't know. No, I mean, it's like, I mean, it's just dystopian. Like,
it is,
you know, just the term human exclusion zone is just so frightening. It's incredible because it both, like, you know, implies some kind of like foreboding, like automated, you know, future or present, I guess. But it also has like a real nasty tinge to us as like humans, right? It makes us seem more and more like machines too, right? We're something foreign to ourselves. It's oh God. Yeah, I don't like that shit at all.
Yeah. But hey, 2-day shipping. So
yeah. But you know, the thing is like, you know, you can achieve a lot of efficiency with increased workforces and better wages and things like that. It's also a big myth that they put is like the only way to provide services that, you know, we've grown accustomed to is with this a huge amount of exploitation. I do think that, you know, there are questions about, like, do we need things to be moving? Like, is the cost worth it to do these kind of things? Absolutely. I'm not endorsing that we need to have 2-day shipping on toothpaste when you can, you know, drive down the road and get it or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that is like a talking point that I think sometimes socialists fall into that really does aid the bosses, which is that, you know, these things couldn't be done any other ways. They could be done and right. They could be achieved with a different model. But the one that we have right now puts profit above, you know, human life and dignity. And that's the problem.
Yeah. Good point.
Well, I wanted to do this just for a little bit at the end. We have a little Leo Panitch that will play sort of at the close of this. But I wanted to talk to you, Matt, and hear your thoughts about this, about the term tanky. If you think that it is a useful term or not.
I will say I have not found it useful personally, mm-hmm. but that might be more the type of conversations I get into. Like, I remember hearing about tanky. I think I've been working at Majority Report already. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to Michael about it, and like I guess the answer is I think there's there's tendencies that are pathological and not going anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Like and kind of not fundamentalist, but like so based in the realm of ideas. Mm-hmm. It's like the idea that in order to make a film, you just need to sit in your room and make the perfect script.
Yeah.
And then somehow people are gonna be like, oh, this script is fucking amazing. Let's give it like right to like David Fincher or whatever, right? Like, no, it's if you want to get something made, you need to know a lot of people who can make films. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, and so that's my, it just seems like people get a little bit too caught up in the ideas. It reminds me of a mirror version of, and again, like, I'm not saying like everybody who's been described a tank, because as we're going to say, like, we've probably been described tankies for certain mm-hmm. the defenses of like, say, Maduro or whatever. It seems like libertarians, like a little bit. I don't know. What you go on.
How libertarians like extremely broad in the way that people use it, or?
Like, it's just too focused on theory, I guess. Like,
oh yeah. So it's like, what, that's a good point too. Well, I would say I don't find the term to be very, very useful. One, because I just see it being used in such a non-targeted way.
Right.
I feel like I don't think from the get-go that it was a very good term. I'm more talking, by the way, about like contemporary like online usage, because like it does have like a history,
right?
And that's what people know. It's like, you know, opposing Soviet invasion of socialist movements, right? And it has like an old history in the UK, right? But you know, it's one of those things that's like, well, nobody's really talking about it.
Found that very confusing. Like, mm-hmm. like marrying the historical context of like, especially of the Hungarian revolt, right? And with whatever the fuck is going on like online with people without profile pictures.
Yeah. And like, we're talking mainly about the online usage because I find that it's probably very rare that's really the context that we're talking about. Though I'll get into the people who actually it might be accurate, but I think that they actually have more of like a pathological problem there than a political one. I don't like the term tanky because there really is no unifying ideology behind it. Like, tanky is not a political position or like a political movement in that kind of sense. What people mean by tanky oftentimes is like, you're defending a regime or a movement or a tendency that I find to be odious, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes correctly, but I think more often than not, incorrectly. I think one thing, especially as Americans, I don't think that it's worthwhile to spend your time defending Stalin to be acting like the history of like socialist and communist movements was some beautiful parade of liberty and justice. There's a lot of positive And there's a lot of negative. I will say, as an orientation, as an American, just, you know, since we're so inundated from our whole life of just like nonsensical horror stories about, you know, the Soviet states and those regimes, that you should actually orient yourself in a way to say like, well, I probably have to unlearn some things and to think a little bit more critically. Like your knee jerk reaction as somebody who's just a product of like, you know, your typical like American high school probably is not going to be the best reaction to these things. Right. Mm-hmm. Not saying that it can't always line up, but I'm just saying like, if you spent your whole life learning about how communism was the most evil force in human history, you know, sometimes bringing that energy into like your newfound leftism or socialist debates probably is not, you have to do some self-criticism, self-analysis is what I'm saying there. But anyways, like Tanki is not like an ideology in the sense that like, there isn't a political movement behind like Tankis, right?
Yeah.
Other than, for the most part, a kind of like online fandom that I think is like very, very loosely related to any kind of reality, right? Because people, especially online now, since like socialism is a popular discourse, they find that if they find like the perfect descriptor of themselves, then they have found, I don't know, that they're doing politics. Right. And politics.
This is what I was talking about. Yeah. This is what I'm talking about with the libertarians. Like, they're like, I'm a Murray Rothbardite, or like, I'm a Hayekian, or whatever the fuck. Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And I think, especially on, you know, platforms like Twitter, right, where you can have like an avatar and like a funny banner name and things like that. That's like very, very loosely related to even yourself and like the world around you. It can be fun to just go on there. Or I'm projecting, but like, you know, it can be like, I would imagine that like, you know, some people get a little bit of pleasure by going on there and tweeting like Stalin did nothing wrong and like, you know, being weirdos, right? But to conflate that, which I think is much more to do with like internet culture, with like a sustained like critique of politics today, I think is a mistake. Yeah. And the only reason I wanted to bring it up is because I see people very much like not wanting to be like, because tanky is a pejorative term, right? Mm-hmm. I get worried because when you start using other terms, right, you let other people do your thinking for you, right? Yeah. And the reason I think tanky has a bit of a dangerous like modern day why it's a risky term to be using, that it's so prevalent to be using, as I see it essentially being used to shut out like Marxists or socialists or people who actually do have very like legitimate criticisms, because by calling somebody a tanky, you now conflate them with the anime Maoists and the anime Stalinists, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's really dangerous, especially if you're living in the United States, you know, a country where from the get-go you are inundated with lies about, you know, history all around on the globe. This is not saying, okay, well, the answer then is to defend, you know, every dictator or every, you know, bad thing, or to deny history or facts. Is to say, this development I don't think is good because it actually like shuts off investigation and debate and conversation.
I agree. Yep. And I'm just looking right now. I've never used the term tanky in a tweet. So, and it's for exactly that reason. Like it's like whether the specific instance of whatever you're describing as tanky-ish is, you know, something you want to criticize, just the general, I guess, wind of that conversation is not helpful, I don't think, for the left.
I mean,
exactly. Like any imperial like struggle or trying to understand what's going on in a different country. I think it's just not useful.
Well, it's like, look, you know, is somebody a Stalinist? Then like engage with them as a Stalinist. Is somebody just like a random apologist? Because there's also like, there is a tendency of people who think that anything that is opposite of the United States is de facto good. I think that's a bad tendency. I critique that. Right. But like, yeah, but the way that term is one, it's too broad, so you're actually never honing in on anything. And what it does more than anything is continue to sort of put, you know, like a more like revolutionary socialist or Marxist perspective, and to paint it in the broadest brush, you know, we're like, you know, it's Ho Chi Minh, a tanky,
right?
You know, people, I mean, people, you know, do say things like that. It's Fidel Castro, you know, a tanky. I think that those are two people who have done a lot of good for the world, and I support. Yeah. You know, I support those movements, not uncritically, but I support those movements and those, you know, that history that is, you know, ongoing. Right. I think it's a really dangerous thing to like make this a part of the culture, right. To use another term that I don't like. But I don't know. Cause yeah, I hope that we can, you know, just think about these things individually. Because when you start to use these other terms, you really just shut out a lot of really critical thinking and analysis that you need.
I think it's, yeah. And I think it's basically just a dagger aimed at like Arauz in Ecuador, for instance, right? Like, yeah. I feel like they set, it's a setup. I feel like it's setting the predicate for declaring any leftist government. The real place it matters is declarations that governments are invalid because they're authoritarian, right? And like, that's really the thing you need to be worried about.
And we're almost giving it too much logic right now. Like, I see people, you know, criticizing anyone who ever like interacts or quotes or talks about like Lenin as a tanky, right? I think that's extremely damaging. There are a lot of people who invoke Lenin, and a lot of people who describe themselves as Marxist Leninists, I don't think have really spent too much time thinking about Leninism as like a political philosophy very, very deeply at all, and rather see that as like it's the only pure form of socialism, and pure in the sense of like it's performative, so I can present to people that I'm better than them. Like, for people who think politics is about expressing that, like, I actually have a better and more moral understanding of things than you do, rather than what politics is the way that we organize together to get free. There are a lot of people who invoke Lenin who I very much disagree with, but I get worried when I see this kind of this kind of term get thrown around so much so that I actually do think that it would stifle, or you create an image in people's mind, especially when so many people are learning about socialism and Marxist philosophy right now. You create an idea like, oh, these are the bad ones and these are the good ones. Yeah. You know, and especially members of DSA, which, you know, has a very unfortunate history of anti-communism that I think is very much being eradicated today. I think people should be very careful about that term. And I don't know, unless you had anything else to add, as a sort of bridge, I wanted to play this just a couple of seconds of Panitch here, because I think the whole tanky debate gets to a kind of problem with, you know, a lot of folks, you know, contemporary left in the US. You know, and when I first became a socialist, I fell into this trap too, which is like, you learn about all these different ideologies and it's like, oh man, I can like find the one true thought. And you know, when I became a socialist, I was doing Occupy, you know, which was like sort of my political activity, but there wasn't any kind of party feeling that there was like party organization to actually having these questions being like practically meaningful. So it was something to cling on to. And I'm finding now more and more as like we are building a left in this country, that getting really fixated on like, oh, what kind of like socialist are you, is not particularly helpful. That doesn't mean not doing criticism or engagement with different thinking, but this kind of idea that like you need to label yourself and then you can engage in politics, I think is unhelpful. And yeah. I think tanky in its like opposite, right? Like if you're somebody who calls somebody a tanky, like you're saying a statement about, you know, your own like politics, you know, too, which I just think is just not the most helpful way to think about it. But anyways, this is Leo Panitch talking about him, you know, who goes on to be one of like the great Marxist socialist theorists of, you know, of our time, how he thought about Marxism growing up as a young kid in Canada, you know, with immigrant parents. And this is from an interview with the Real News Network, which is a personal favorite.
It wasn't so much Marx as people who, you know, were themselves be accused of being Marxist, perhaps. I'd never thought of myself as a Marxist. One didn't growing up in a working class home in that sense, people who didn't define themselves that way. I remember it was only in second year university that I whispered to a friend who I ended up writing that last book you just mentioned with, Sam Gindin. I just had read the preface of the Critique of Political Economy, which I now think is pretty crude. But I remember reading that and whispering to Sam, I think I'm a Marxist. And I think one knew that that was a bit of a frisson. It was, you know, you were going past where the left is safely goes within a good company or establishment company. I want to say, though, that the Winnipeg I grew up in, differently from others, I think, of my generation, who were middle class or upper middle class, the children of lawyers or doctors or businessmen, I grew up in working class Winnipeg, not upwardly mobile. So my memories of the 1950s were much more about my dad being laid off every winter, my mother going to work as a night cleaner in the bank when my father got laid off. A lot of the left, a lot of socialist feminists in the 1970s developed this notion as a bad notion of the family wage. My mother was the strongest proponent of the family wage, because when my dad wasn't getting a pay increase or was laid off and unemployed, she had to go out and be a night cleaner in a bank, right? So I would hear the word scab in a strike more often from my mother than I would from my father, right? I remember my father pulling me onto his lap when I was already, I think, in grade 9, came home at 4 o'clock, and there he was at the kitchen table. He pulled me on his lap and started crying. And I realized what had happened. He had either lost his job or been laid off that day. If he was in a bad mood, I got the sense it was because he'd been told off by some foreman, and that he was someone who was much more educated, not in a formal sense, than this bastard who had told him off. There was a certain resentment in the household that I could tell when we would go to the odd time to a synagogue, and, you know, my father would point to some rich businessman who could barely spell his name, but who was sitting next to the rabbi because he had contributed so much to the community, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that, but I love that clip a lot, actually.
Good.
One, because, I mean, this is the synthesis that I've been trying to dance around, and not just in this conversation, but a lot lately, is telling people that there's a kind of fixation with, like, just getting this, like, this correct label and, like, finding the correct ideology that I think is unhelpful. But I get worried sometimes when I also hear that critique, because a lot of times what people then go to is like, well, this is why we shouldn't be reading theory or, like, thinking, like, you know, seriously about politics. This is somebody making, you know, who goes on to dedicate his life to this study, but making the very, very critical point that, you know, the real serious working class consciousness that he grew up around, that was developing, that he was seeing from his mother and his father, was unique and different in opposition, talking about his mother in relation to the family wage, you know, and it's in somewhat opposition to a kind of more, you know, academic socialism. But also that, you know, engaging with these ideas later in life becomes something that's a very important tool for organizing and finding a pathway forward. So it's just like the synthesis that I'm trying to find is like, not getting so fixated on like finding like an ideology for you to like personally identify with, as much as building a political consciousness that's informed by all these great movements and theorists and leaders and, you know, and ideas that are out there. Right. And having that sort of be the crux of your socialist politics and your, you know, your working class like consciousness, instead of, I don't know, a kind of like loose feeling of camaraderie, and with movements that are, you know, 100 years old, or with people who like you can engage with today, right? It's just saying like, oh, I need to like defend, you know, Lenin's honor against, you know, attacks right. against him, right? Insisting like, you know, I mean, maybe personally I would do that, but I wouldn't find that to be like, this is the most important political fight. What I do find is like, okay, let's engage with the theory of imperialism. Let's think about things like the Vanguard Party, like a lot of these things that are laid out, right? Like engaging with these things in the same way with Marx and his theories as well, right? It's finding a way to do this without this like kind of performative outward-facing attachment that yeah. a lot of people fall into.
Yeah, and I don't want anything I said to be misconstrued as being against reading or anything like that anyway, but I think you need to treat this stuff as tools and not the message, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think too many, I think we're, right, like it's like the rose emoji, right? Like, I think it's great, and I'm not judging people for doing that. I love, you know, every other work people are doing in DSA, but like we're used to treating these things as messages, as if that's going to do it for us. Mm-hmm. And really it's not that it's just a tool that should be in the background that you can sort of go to in case you need to, and when you need to, I think.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the point. I think the tools point is the way to think about it, because there's like, because now we're sort of dipping our toe into another thing, and we'll have to do that in another conversation. But like the tension between like life experience and like theory, right? There's always like, this is always the most pointless argument that you see on the internet, right? Which is like, I just don't think that what we should be telling people is that they need to read this book to be a socialist, right? And it's like, well, first of all, no one is saying that except for maybe like a Looney Tune weirdo, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually like, as like, you know, a poor working class, you know, somebody who comes from like those worlds, I do think that there is a lot of class consciousness that, you know, is organically developing. And I think that people, especially who don't come from those backgrounds, should be more prepared to engage with that and to recognize that. But this kind of like either or fixation that people get into with this thing is extremely silly. The first thing that every socialist movement in successful socialist movement in history has done has been mass education, both like a classical liberal education and political education, right? Because they recognize that these things are incredible tools for us, right? But you know, and that being said, you know, the bourgeoisie has completely extracted, has been very successful in extracting actual class analysis and, Jesus Christ, class politics from even Marxist theories. I mean, we're going through that period now of just trying to reinsert, you know, class into, you know, left education, you know, from people who supposedly are coming from a, you know, a tradition that is fixed, you know, that's supposed to be about emancipation. You know, I like these, there are all these tensions here, and I just find this like kind of surface level way that they're often dealt with is extremely unhelpful. And then the energy that we have these kind of proxy fights,
yeah,
right? Where people are like, well, I don't want to tell some guy who's working, you know, 10 hours a day that he needs to read a book to do. No, of course, because that'd be a really stupid way to get someone to show up to your meeting, right? but also this kind of like ahistorical, immaterial way of thinking about class politics and class consciousness in this country is inaccurate too. Because if you think, like, one of the most dangerous beliefs that socialists have had historically, especially like bourgeois social, like people who come from a certain kind of upper class background, is that there is just going to be this organic like awakening. Right, that like class consciousness and class politics are just like a natural function and not a process that you have to like consciously build. And I just don't want to fall into that failure, because this is where you see, especially in the US, a lot of like the infection of like modern liberal philosophy into like socialist movements.
Well, do you have an example or what
kind like, you know, so when you like standpoint epistemology, right, kind of thing, right? Where it, you know, it's like obviously like the point is to be like fighting and bringing in working people, you know, as sorry, fighting for and fighting with and bringing in working people into these movements as much as possible. But there's just like this kind of refusal to recognize that there has to be a conscious effort to build class consciousness and do political education, right? That like we live in a country that has very much set up its education system and popular media and stuff like that to mystify people, to make the world seem extremely, extremely confusing, to hide the fact that we're all very much united in a common struggle against the bosses and the wealthy in the society. And to think that like you can just like that you don't have to engage with that problem at all, I think is a mistake. And I think that very much comes from a kind of liberal philosophy is too vague, but it's hard to figure out the best term for it. But this idea that like, you know, politics and like the way we engage with the world is just like an expression of like all of our different identities.
This is a little bit spicy, but we're on a post game. I was thinking about the slogan about Black Trans Lives Matter. And obviously I think the intent behind that is very good, but I was just thinking the hypothetical, if you put working class Black Trans Lives Matter, what the effect of people would be. And I think you'd have a lot of upset people. And I think that kind of says a lot about maybe the liberal element of politics that you're talking about.
Yeah. I get worried about that more than anything because, we have extremely ineffective models of thinking about politics and the world that are very comfortable in university classrooms across the U.S. for a reason. And I think that, you know, what should be taken with us is like more and more of attitudes to consider, you know, a myriad of different, you know, perspectives and people and recognize historical injustices and things like that, bring the best of those movements into our politics. But not to accept the form of liberal politics, which just doesn't have any engine to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And cause that's like, that's the nightmare scenario, right? Is that we get a lot of popular movement and education, but we do it so in a way that like doesn't mobilize people. It immobilizes folks. People who I was really into them for a while, but like, hegemony and socialist strategy is a great example of this like complete decentering of class politics that ended up dominating, the early 21st century social left movements in Europe in particular, what we call now left populism. And maybe this is opening up a can of worms and we might just, maybe make this as a preview to have a conversation about this later, was really damaging because basically you have this idea that like the era of class politics is over and instead we'll just have like a kind of more liberal and squishy understanding of like what the central agent of like political change is going to be. And now we're sitting here in 2021, and those movements haven't been successful.
Well, on that note, folks, we'll be back. Do you know what you're going to do on your Griscom stream?
I don't know. I'll have to figure that out. Any suggestions are very welcome.
I will be doing a Twitch stream tomorrow. I'm going to do, because we have all day off tomorrow, so I'm going to be twitching both Left Reckoning and Literary Hangover. So nice. Stop on by. I'll probably do, I'm not sure. I've been sleeping a little bit too late lately. probably around sometime in the afternoon. But and then on Thursday, Kurt Hackbarth.
Yeah, real excited for that. We're going to talk about AMLO his legacy so far as president, and also this huge fight that country is happening with both the national and the international bourgeoisie. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. And also, you know, just some other things in the pipeline. We'll be doing a deep dive into Georgia, the country, in the next few weeks. So I'll have more to announce on that later.
Awesome. Patrons, thank you so much. We've been cruising. Thanks to all the new patrons that have joined in the last month. 100 of you folks about there. So we appreciate you very, very much. And we'll see you next time.